deaths of Shimi Sun and Shin Hyo-soon, ran over by a U.S. military vehicle on their way to their friend's birthday party on June 13, 2002. The children's family's lawyer hopes for change in U.S. relations and influence on Korea.
The massacre of two middle school students is a symbol of unequal South Korea-U.S. relations. In that regard, I think that the work of candlelight among our people to establish an equal relationship between South Korea and the United States in the future and move toward peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula remains unfinished.
Two U.S. soldiers were charged with negligent homicide, but acquitted in a U.S. military court amid anti-American candlelight protests. The deaths of Mi Sun and Hyo Soon under the tracks of a U.S. military vehicle 20 years ago are but one episode of a problematic alliance relationship, from the Status of Forces Agreement to the cost of hosting 28,500 troops in South Korea. Alliance ties are a constant source of controversy and debate. Some argue South Koreans view the presence of U.S. forces as an obstacle preventing the country from exercising sovereignty.
It's not fit for the global era and very risky for South Korea to cling to a falling sun with the status of American hegemony declining so much. I hope we can establish more neutral diplomacy reflecting our national interests.
New President Yoon Suk-yeol seeks to strengthen the South Korea-U.S. alliance, a shift in policy that worries many South Koreans. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iranian Presidents Ebrahim Raisi and his visiting Venezuelan counterpart Nicolas Maduro have signed a 20-year document on comprehensive strategic cooperation, which mainly covers a wide range of areas including petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural and political fields. In a press briefing after the signing ceremony, President Raisi and his Venezuelan counterpart Maduro said the two countries should work together closely in areas such as trade, economy, agriculture, as well as science and technology. They also hailed establishment of direct Tehran-Caracas flights as an opportunity to enhance relations and bring the two nations closer.
Venezuela has shown that it has put up exemplary resistance against the enemy's threats, sanctions, and imperialism. The Iranian nation, too, has been under numerous sanctions and threats for more than 40 years now. But the Iranian people have turned these sanctions into an opportunity to further make progress.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Earlier on Friday, in an interview with Iran's Spanish TV channel Hispan TV, Maduro said Venezuela and Iran are on the front line of shaping a world free of imperialism and dominant powers. Maduro also hailed Iran's courageous move to send fuel tankers to his energy-hungry nation, saying Tehran's delivery of oil to Caracas was a great help to the Venezuelan people. Heading a high-ranking political-economic delegation, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro arrived in Tehran on a two-day state visit at the invitation of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi. This is his second visit to Tehran. The first one took place about 6 years ago. Both Iran and Venezuela have managed to withstand the economic pressures from the United States and have closely cooperated to offset the impact of the illegal sanctions, especially in their energy sectors. Salman Kujrip, Tehran.
In the Muslim-majority Indian-administered Kashmir, people observed a shutdown to denounce the derogatory remarks by two members of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against Prophet Muhammad. After condemnations by the global Muslim community, the two were suspended. Despite strict security arrangements, people in the summer capital, Srinagar, took to the streets saying they have tolerated everything so far, but nothing against their beloved prophet.
We demand stringent punishment against these culprits. No religion teaches intolerance. What we see growing attacks on Muslims and their emotions in India now.
These two people have dented the image of Hinduism on the global forum by speaking against the prophet of Islam. Scores of Muslim countries are today upset about India and its behavior towards minority Muslims. We have tolerated a lot, be it scraping of Article 370 or delimitation, but this time it's about our beloved Prophet, will take to the streets without fearing any consequences.
In Srinagar, mobile internet services were suspended as a precautionary measure to avoid the snowballing of protests. Government forces were seen deployed in strength while people closed down businesses, shops and other activities. Last week, BJP suspended its national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, who made anti-Islam remarks on a TV debate last month. Also, Naveen Kumar Jindal was expelled from the party over his blasphemous tweets about the Prophet Muhammad. The controversial remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, have sparked global outrage against India. The Muslim community across the world is denouncing the growing anti-Muslim ideology and hate crimes against the minorities in the country. They're accusing BJP of backing anti-Muslim ideology in what they call once a secular India. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by 0.25% next month, most likely 0.5% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, the cost of living is high already, and then so if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, calculate like exactly what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court.
It's a discussion that I've had also with our US colleagues. We are on the same line to try to see what is possible to do. But you know that we try to promote the rule of law.
Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics say Western powers were wrong not to listen to Moscow's security concerns as they built up military capabilities close to Russia's borders and refused to rule out Ukraine joining NATO. ECB bosses are due to meet again to discuss the financial crisis on the 21st of July. Many are asking if the EU's focus stays on arming Ukraine and not conflict resolution, how can things possibly improve between now and then? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A daily occurrence in Donetsk, a building going up in smoke. It was hit by Ukrainian shelling. This time it's an industrial warehouse, but targets like this are not usual.
Now, working as a journalist here, whenever I have nothing else planned, I simply follow the incoming here in Donetsk. And when I arrived at the fifth school that had been hit in as many days, the penny started to drop. And I asked my translator, a local woman with her two-year-old child herself, does the Ukrainian army intentionally shell schools? She replied as if it was the most normal thing in the world. Well, yes, they've been doing it for the last 8 years.
School 5, 13, 22, 33, 57, 106, 114, 116. There are dozens more. So why is Ukraine purposefully targeting schools? In 2014, when the shelling began, former Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko made this famous speech.
Because we will have our jobs and they will not. We will have our pensions and they will not. We will have care for our children, people and retirees, and they will not. Our children will go to schools and kindergartens and theirs will hole up in the basements because they are not able to do a thing. This is exactly how we will win this war.
Six schools were hit only this week. They would like to create a humanitarian crisis here, so as many of us leave as possible. They think that this is their land and the Russian-speaking people are foreigners. They want us to leave to Russia. That's why they shell civilians here every day.
In 2014, School 57 was hit on the exact day the students returned for the school year. 10 people were killed.
Now, for obvious reasons, for the last 8 years, children here in Donetsk have learnt from home. The school around the corner was hit on the 30th of May this year. And on that day, children were expected or scheduled to come back to school for exams, which begs the question, are the Ukrainian army trying to maximise casualties here at these schools?
There are wounded and killed people every day. Children are dying too. My son is 4 years old. He hasn't seen peaceful life yet. He knows what war is, though. And he likes the soldiers who defend us. When my district was on the shelling, we were hiding in the corridor. He was afraid. He took the phone and started shouting into it, "Please, soldiers, come and help us." I think every mom here has got a similar story.
During 8 years of conflict, 117 children have been killed in the DPR. The Ukrainian government claims the city is still part of its country. The inescapable fact is that NATO is arming a government that is using its weapons to blow up, as it claims, its own schools and to target children. Perhaps the most shocking part of this story is that most of the world has turned a blind eye to the mountain of evidence of these crimes for 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The moment an exhibition turned into a series of violent assaults committed by the MKO, a cult-like organization that has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. Press TV's camera crew, reporting on an exhibition showcasing MKO bombings and assassinations, was attacked by angry supporters of the group.
Don't touch my camera. Don't touch my camera. Go deep.
After being driven out of post-revolution Iran, the MKO based itself in Camp Ashraf in Iraq, where members were forced to pledge allegiance to its leader Massoud Rajavi and demonstrate that allegiance with cult-like behavior for women that meant divorcing their husbands and marrying him. Many families spent years on the fringes of the camp begging for their children to be released, but to no avail. The camp was later dismantled in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Until 2012, the MKO was on the U.S. terrorist list. It was also blacklisted by the EU until 2009. Since being removed, the new leader of the cult, Mariam Rajavi, has forged close relationships with Western officials.
What unfolded on the streets of Stockholm today was a shocking reminder that the EU has become a safe haven for the MKO, which attacks journalists like myself with little fear of retribution. The question now is, will there be an investigation? Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you.
and the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
While the U.S. is entangled in the Ukraine conflict, it is also pursuing another confrontational approach on the other side of the world, namely with China. At the Shangri-La Dialogue Security Summit, which ended in Singapore, China's defense minister hit back at the Pentagon chief Lloyd Austin, who accused Beijing of, quote, destabilizing military activity. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at what steps Beijing would take when it says that it had no choice but to fight if attempts are made to separate Taiwan from China. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Mike Billington joins us from the Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg, Virginia. Also joining us is Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, who joins us from San Francisco.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Mike, the only thing I'll first start with you. When you have the U.S. Defense Minister meeting his counterpart from China face-to-face for the first time, he issues a warning pretty much, saying that Beijing must refrain from further destabilizing actions towards Taiwan, and that's a quote. Do you think that that's the right approach that the U.S. is using in this case in point in that summit which ended from the U.S. Defense Minister?
No, I think it's actually worse than that. I think it's good that they met, but what Austin did was totally in keeping with the incredibly belligerent, provocative moves by the U.S. towards Russia and towards China. I will add something to what you quoted from Austin, which I think is far more ominous. He said at one point, and I'll read this. He said that we will continue to fulfill our commitments under the Taiwan Relations Act. That's normal. And that includes assisting Taiwan in maintaining a sufficient self-defense capability. That's also normal. That's part of the longstanding U.S. policy. But then he goes on and says, and it means maintaining our own capacity to resist any use of force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize the security or the social or economic system of the people of Taiwan. Now think of that. That is an open declaration refuting absolutely even the ambiguity policy of the U.S. and explicitly it confirms what President Biden said, which many people described as a gaffe, that we would militarily defend Taiwan in the case of a conflict. Which means that if the Chinese government chooses by force or whatever reason that they have to consolidate their sovereignty over their province of Taiwan under the One China, Two Systems policy, that the U.S. would launch a global war. Does he mean that? Is this meant to be simply provocative to get China to back down? It's very difficult to say, but the problem we're facing is that the U.S. and the British and the NATO forces have repeatedly stated that they intend to win this fight to prevent Russia and China and, by the way, most of the rest of the world, which does not support the sanctions on Russia and does not support the demonization of China, but in fact continue to support Russia and China and have economic relations with them. But does it mean that they will either submit to the now obviously no longer true unipolar world?
Sure.
The myth that the U.S. continues to be the only force in the world and that the so-called rules-based order, which simply means the rules we make after having won the Cold War, as they like to put it, rather than the international law established by all nations after World War II. The UN and international law has been basically dismissed by this policy.
All right, Richard Becker, what are we to make of U.S. foreign policy when it comes to China, when you have what our guest Mike Billington said there from Lloyd Austin, where he then comes out in the same forum saying another thing, such as reaffirming the importance of peace and stability across the strait, opposition to unilateral changes to the status quo, and calling on China to refrain from further destabilizing action towards Taiwan. To add and to question then what Mike Billington said, do you believe that the U.S., if China did make a move, would react and therefore start a war with China?
I think that we have to assume that very well could happen. And we should remember that February, just this past February, the end of February, marked the 50th anniversary of the Shanghai Communique. And the Shanghai communique was issued in the Nixon presidency, with Kissinger taking the lead in this, and between the U.S. and the People's Republic of China, saying that parties on both sides of the strait recognize that there is one China. What we see happening now means that has been completely overturned by the United States, that declaration that there is one China. In fact, the United States is engaging in the most provocative behavior, pouring weaponry and trainers, and we don't know how many U.S. troops and trainers and advisors there are now in Taiwan, but we have to assume that it's a great many, really the U.S. is treating the neocons who are running the foreign policy in Washington are treating Taiwan not as if it's part of China. They never fully did, but now it's very blatant that they're treating Taiwan as an independent country. And more importantly, though, than that, in fact, is that they don't really care about what happens to people in Taiwan. They don't care what happens to people in the Philippines or Okinawa or Japan. They are all part of what the Pentagon calls the first island chain. That is, they view them as bases. And it was just a few months ago that the head of the Indo-PAC, as they now call it, military command for the U.S., said that the first island chain countries must be prepared for war, not just war, but to be able to come back. After they are first attacked, they have to have redundancy in their weaponry so that they can continue fighting against China in the event of a war, which I think that everyone believes is very well coming. So, I think that's an important point to make. The pretense in Washington that they care about the interests of any people has to be thrown out the window and replaced with reality, which is that this is a struggle to bring China down, to bring Russia and China down. And it's not my words. In 2017, the end of 2017, and ratified in early 2018, the latest national security strategy says that the war against terrorism has been replaced with major power competition or major power rivalry. And with the U.S. meaning that Russia and China are the targets and the context of the drive to make the U.S. the one and only superpower in the world. That's what the aim really is.
Well, let's hopefully clarify through you, Mike Billington, the deal that the U.S. has with these countries that it has military bases on. I know there's a status of forces agreement that it has with Japan. What is that exactly? From what I understand, is that the U.S. can order the Japanese military, if it wants to take military action, for them to oblige, if that's a correct understanding of it. But what type of control does the U.S. have when it comes to these island nations or any country in that part of the world that they have bases in and their militaries?
Well, they have a serious problem in the Philippines from their view, because especially under the Duterte administration, but almost certainly also under the Marcos administration, that they will return to the kind of policy under Marcos's father, Ferdinand Marcos, who was one of the great nationalist leaders of Asia, who industrialized his country, built nuclear power plants, made the country self-sufficient in agriculture. And it was for that reason that they demonized him and ran a color revolution to have him deposed, after which the country deteriorated into being one of the most poorest and most oppressed countries in the region. So they're not sure they're going to have access to the military bases that they have, in a sense, still in the Philippines, within the Philippine bases. As to whether or not Japan will follow dictates, you might say, to join in such a war, Prime Minister Kishida gave the keynote at the Shangri-La Dialogue, where Austin was speaking, in which he echoed all of the U.S., NATO, British demonization of Russia, that he's fully joined in the attacks on Russia, and then said that the China problem with Taiwan that they're belligerent, they're aggressive, and that they're going to rebuild their military over the next 5 years. Now, I will add to that, though, a voice of caution. There is a upper house election in Japan early next month. There will not be another election for about 3 years. There are many, including friends of mine in Japan, former high-level officials, who believe that Kishida is making these kinds of statements in full support of the outrageous war policies coming out of the U.S. And Britain, more for domestic purposes, and that following the election, when there won't be another election for about 3 years, that he will modify this and return more to the kind of policy Abe had of being friendly with Russia and doing business with China and maintaining a certain balance. I will also add that there is there's a fight back taking place around the world against this U.S. British unipolar world mentality. Jai Shankar, the foreign minister of India, just last week said, Eurocentrism is dead. We will no longer follow dictates. And of course, that includes the U.S. from the West. Meeting of the South American, the Nations of the Americas meeting in Los Angeles, in which the U.S. refused to invite three members because they considered them, you know, authoritarian dictatorships, led to the complete collapse of that event. Not only did Mexico and the Triangle countries not attend, they just boycotted it and said, we're not going to tolerate your dictating who are members of the Latin American countries. But also Fernandez from Argentina, who did go, blasted this as an outrage. There are forces within the U.S., former high-level Army JAG officer, Colonel Richard Black, whose video warning that the U.S. mobilization for war against Russia, potentially nuclear war, with China obviously next in line,
right,
that this is madness, that this is creating a danger to humanity, and that this video has now 750,000 views. This is an interview I did with Colonel Black for the Schiller Institute. So there are reasons to be relatively optimistic if we fight hard now to inform, break through the information of war being waged by the Western media and the Western financial system, and bring these kinds of realities to the American people as well as the Europeans, that we can turn this situation away from the disaster it's heading for now. And partially, that's because the hyperinflationary breakdown of the Western financial system is affecting everybody. Everybody now knows that the Western financial structure is in a state of total decay and collapse. Therefore, people have to think about what can we do to bring about a new paradigm of the sort that the Schiller Institute and Helga Zepp LaRouche have been fighting for with our conferences and our videos.
Well, Richard Becker, Mike Billington talked about the nuclear possibility between Russia and the States. There was a statement that came out of China that is pretty interesting that was made by the defense minister to his counterpart. And he said something about to the point where there's been significant progress that China has made in developing new arms. And this is in regards to its nuclear arsenal. So that was in itself somewhat eye-opening. But then he made this statement. I wonder if you have seen China's 70th anniversary National Day military parade and the new weapons and equipment available to the Chinese military, in which he then went on to say, but we don't engage in an arms race. So is that a subtle hint as to what the U.S. would face if it wanted to go on a military adventure with China?
Well, first of all, let me say, I must take exception with your other guest characterization of the Marcos regime. It was really the U.S. Marcos regime that was overthrown by an uprising of the people. And the U.S., back in 1986, and the U.S. managed to transition it to another subservient regime. As far as what's going on in regard to to speak of China's military buildup, what does anyone think that China would do in the face of a massive U.S. military buildup? I mean, this is a vast buildup throughout Asia surrounding China, in Taiwan. Japan still has to point out, Japan still has at least 84 military, U.S. military bases. Most of them are joint bases, or many of them are joint bases between the so-called Japan Self-Defense Forces and the U.S. That 84 doesn't even include Okinawa, which is covered, or 20% or so of the land or more is U.S. military bases in Okinawa. And then there's Korea. I mean, there's a vast deployment of military, of U.S. military already in place, and more coming, that the buildup is underway and it is continuing. So whenever we hear people say, and like the U.S. generals, they're alarmed by China developing new forms of weaponry. Really? I mean, that is so ludicrous when it comes out of the mouths of those who represent the biggest military contractor in the world by far, the biggest arms sales in the world, and the number one power in terms of developing new weapon systems, including modernizing, quote unquote, put the word in quotation marks, its nuclear arsenal. What's that for? I mean, that's promises nothing except death and destruction and possibly the annihilation of life on the planet. Sure. That's what we really see happening with the danger that we see coming from the U.S. aggression in against Russia. And Defense Secretary, and again, I would put that in quotation marks, Lloyd Austin, said just a few weeks ago, the aim of the U.S. is not supporting or protecting the Ukrainian people, it's to weaken Russia. And the U.S. is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian to do that.
Well, and since we're quickly running out of time, I have to ask your reaction, Mike Billington, on what the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, said just last month. I mean, it really lays out the way that the U.S. feels about China, in which he says China is the most serious long-term threat to the world order, and that Beijing's vision would move us away from the universal values that have sustained so much of the world's progress. But I thought the impression that everybody had was that, and the U.S. included, was that China is technologically more advanced, like the 5G technology that it has. And yet Blinken's statement there is a diversion from that.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, what Blinken means by universal values are the values that allow the United States to wage regime change wars anywhere it wishes over and over and over again. I agree with most of what Richard has been saying. I will just say that if you want to get a sense of how one of the first color revolutions, the way that Marcos was overthrown, I encourage you to go to the Executive Intelligence Review website and read my material on how George Shultz and Paul Wolfowitz ran that so-called People's Power Revolt, which was a model then for their efforts to destroy countries all over the world through color revolutions. As to the blatant policy of Blinken following in line with the Obama policies, Obama-Biden policies for basically imposing regime change wars in places like Ukraine in 2014, and now openly running an effort to overthrow the regimes in Russia and China, that this is a policy which is only going to be reversed if we can bring the world together, including the U.S., to recognize that what is really threatening humanity right now is that the Western financial system is in a state of total collapse. We're holding a conference on the 18th and 19th, next weekend, on the theme that there will be no peace if the Western financial system is not put through bankruptcy reorganization. This is possible at this point because, as I said, everybody in the world is now aware of the devastating breakdown crisis, hyperinflationary breakdown crisis of that financial system, and that Russia and China have been working very closely together. Sergei Glazyev from Russia and Wang Wen from the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies at Renmin University in formulating a new financial policy for the world, not
exactly.
Just for themselves, not just trading in local currencies, but putting together an alternative which we can and must bring the United States through a popular mobilization to join with them. And our conference on the 18th and 19th,
well,
the Schiller Institute conference, will focus on that urgent necessity.
Sure. There is a lot of talk on this, Richard Becker, and it's we don't have that much time to talk about it, but there appears to be a very gigantic tectonic shift, if I may use that word, of a new world order, financially speaking, of which one of it is the fact that the U.S. dollar strength is going to decrease as we're seeing the forces move forward, such as the way that Russia and Iran, for example, are experiencing the way that they evade sanctions. And of course, there's also the question of energy, where you have countries like Russia, Iran, and just the recent visit by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to Iran. You have these major oil powerhouses in one camp. Of course, you also can talk about Russia, China in that picture, where it all points to the U.S. Influence and power on the wane here. Are we looking at that to be the savior to prevent another war from happening? Because the war with China, I think, would be a totally different ballgame than the one that we're seeing with Ukraine.
Yeah, you know, I think that I just came back last night from Los Angeles from the People's Summit for Democracy, where well over 1,000 people from all over the hemisphere gathered as a counterpoint to the Organization of American States, a failed summit of the Americas. I mean, really a failure, a true humiliation for the United States, where the leaders of 20 countries, the heads of 20 states in the Americas did not show up in protest of the U.S. embargo, sanctions, blockade policy against Cuba, against Venezuela, and the exclusion of those two countries and the leadership of and the leaders of Nicaragua and, or any representation from Nicaragua. And so their summit was a failure. I mean, it was a complete failure, and the People's Summit was a true success. And I think it was a sign that the U.S. policy, that the U.S. power is slipping in different parts of the world. I think we have to also take into account, though, that when that happens, the imperialists may become more aggressive, more adventuristic, and I think that's something we have to be very concerned about. We have to build a people's movement on the ground in solidarity with each other across the Americas and across the world to call for an end to U.S. aggression and belligerence and the threat of new wars, even more destructive wars.
Okay, Mike Billington, final question along the same lines of what I asked Richard Becker. When you have so much energy focused on a number of countries that are not U.S. friendly, to say the least, let's just imagine if Russia actually takes over Ukraine by some sense and takes over their production of grain. You could see that then you have food in that picture also. Then is that something that would prevent the U.S. from its hegemonic aspirations or its expansionist policies as we see?
Well, again, the only way reversed is for people to recognize that the driving force behind the U.S.-British-NATO push for war against Russia and against China, not Ukraine, it's not Taiwan. Baker is right that they have for the people in Ukraine or the people in Taiwan. The purpose is that the Western financial system is breaking down, and they see that Russia and China have posed an alternative, and their reaction is
all right. I'm sorry, I got to jump in, Mike Billington. We're just fresh out of time. I do apologize for that. Wish we had more time. Mike Billington from the Executive Intelligence Review, Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vitagui and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Researchers are learning more about how the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus stifles smell and how they might revive it. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Michael Marshall Ryder. This article is published under the heading COVID and Smell Loss. Answers begin to emerge. Here's more. Researchers are finally making headway in understanding how the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus causes loss of smell, and a multitude of potential treatments to tackle the condition are undergoing clinical trials, including steroids and blood plasma. Once a telltale sign of COVID-19, smell disruption is becoming less common as the virus evolves. Our inboxes are not as flooded as they used to be, says Valentina Parma, a psychologist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, who helped field desperate inquiries from patients throughout the first 2 years of the pandemic. A study published last month surveyed 616,318 people in the U.S. who had COVID-19. It found that compared with those who had been infected with the original virus, people who had contracted the Alpha variant, the first variant of concern to arise, were 50% as likely to have chemosensory disruption. This probability fell to 44% for the later Delta variant and to 17% for the latest variant, Omicron. But the news is not all good. A significant portion of people infected early in the pandemic still experience chemosensory effects. A 2021 study followed 100 people who had had mild cases of COVID-19 and 100 people who repeatedly tested negative. More than a year after their infections, 46% of those who had had COVID-19 still had smell problems. By contrast, just 10% of the control group had developed some smell loss, but for other reasons. Furthermore, 7% of those who had been infected still had total smell loss or anosmia at the end of the year. Given that more than 500 million cases of COVID-19 had been confirmed worldwide, tens of millions of people probably have lingering smell problems. For these people, help can't come soon enough. Simple activities such as tasting food or smelling flowers are now really emotionally distressing, Parma says. A clearer picture of how SARS-CoV-2 causes this disruption should help to create better therapies for the condition. Early in the pandemic, a study showed that the virus attacks cells in the nose called sustenonuclear cells that provide nutrients and support to other sensing neurons. Since then, clues have emerged about what happens to the olfactory neurons after infection. Researchers, including biochemist Stavros Lomrados at Columbia University, New York, examined people who had died from COVID-19 and found that although their neurons were intact, they had fewer membrane-embedded receptors for detecting odor molecules than usual. This was because the neurons' nuclei had been scrambled. Normally, the chromosomes in these nuclei are organized into two compartments, a structure that enables the neurons to express specific odor receptors at high levels. But when the team looked at the autopsied neurons, the nuclear architecture was unrecognizable, Lombard says. Other studies suggest why only some people experience long-term smell loss. In January, a research team reported finding a genetic mutation in people that was associated with a greater propensity for smell or taste loss. The mutation, a change to a single letter or base of DNA, was found in two overlapping genes called UGT2A1 and UGT2A2. Both encode proteins that remove odor molecules from the nostrils after they have been detected. But it's not yet clear how SARS-CoV-2 interacts with these genes. There is also evidence of lasting changes to the brain for people with smell loss. In a study published in March 6, 6,785 people in the U.S. had their brains scanned twice. About 400 people became infected with COVID-19 between scans, so the scientists were able to observe structural changes. The COVID-19 survivors showed multiple changes, including markers of tissue damage in areas likened to the brain's olfactory center. It's not clear why this was the case, but one possibility is lack of input. In the meantime, many treatments are being explored, often in small clinical trials. But it's still early days, so the only thing that most researchers recommend for now is smell training. Patients are given samples of strong-smelling substances to sniff and try to identify, with the aim of driving the restoration of olfactory signaling. However, the method seems to work only with people who have partial smell loss, Reed says. That means it helps about one-third of people who experienced a chemosensory disruption after COVID-19, adds Parma. To find treatments for everyone else, many researchers are exploring steroids, which reduce inflammation. COVID-19 is known to trigger extensive inflammation, which might play a part in a smell disruption. So, in theory, steroids could help, but in practice, the results have been disappointing. For instance, a 2021 study gave a smell training to 100 people with post-COVID anosmia. 50 of them also received a nasal spray with the steroid memostone furoate, while the other 50 did not. There was no significant difference in outcome between the two groups. And another therapeutic possibility is platelet-rich plasma. This is made from patients' own blood and is rich in biochemicals that might induce healing. A pilot study published in 2020 followed seven patients who had platelet-rich plasma injected into their noses. Five showed improvement after 3 months. Similarly, a preprint published in February this year followed 56 people and found that platelet-rich plasma made them more sensitive to smells. But these are really small numbers, says Carl Pilot, a nose and sinus specialist at the University of East Anglia, Norwich, UK. A US-based team is now launching a larger study. Pilot is in early stages of a small study of vitamin A, which previous experiments have suggested could help with other forms of smell loss. Pilot says
The reality is that the study will take the rest of this year to run, and it will take us probably to the middle of next year before we analyze the data and report it. If we find a positive benefit, our next job will be to apply for more funding to do a full stage trial.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.